In Chantilly, Isser was losing patience. At midnight, he picked up the phone. "Get me Harman in Washington," he ordered. When the connection was established, he was blunt. "Harman," he said, "this is Isser Harel. I want you to get in touch with Attorney General Robert Kennedy immediately and tell him in my name that the FBI should get the boy at once." Harman was stunned. "Isser, how can you talk like that?" He hinted that the American services might be monitoring their conversation. "So much the better," Isser said. "I am not talking only to you." He hoped that the Americans were listening in and his firm stand would rouse them to action. Harman kept hesitating and tried to warn Isser about possible diplomatic complications. "I didn't ask your opinion," Isser snapped. "Tell them that if they don't act immediately, they will be held responsible for anything that happens." A few hours later, Isser was called to the telephone. It was New York. The consulate officials informed him that Robert Kennedy had taken immediate action. A team of FBI agents, accompanied by the Israeli security officer, had gone to Brooklyn. The child was indeed found and taken to a safe place. It was Yosela. A young reporter named Elie Wiesel, the future Nobel Prize winner, called Gur Aryeh. "I heard that you found the child." Gur Aryeh, who had been sworn to secrecy, firmly denied. Wiesel didn't forgive him for years. The 4th of July, 1962, was a national holiday in Israel as well, as on that day the plane carrying Yosela home landed at Lod Airport. The press enthusiastically praised the dedicated efficiency of the Secret Service. Israel was fast becoming the only country in the world where that shadow organization was loved and admired by the whole nation. A well-known Israeli lawyer, Shlomo Cohen Zidon, wrote a letter of thanks to Ben-Gurion for finding the child. Ben-Gurion wrote back, "You should thank our secret services and mostly their head, who spent days and nights on that mission and didn't rest, even when his assistants almost gave up, till he found the child and pulled him out of his hideout, which was not easy either." While all of Israel was celebrating Yosela's rescue, Isser was in Paris, where his men threw a modest party for him. One of the agents raised his glass, "To the child returned to his fatherland, to the iron-willed man who found him, to the state that knows so well to protect its citizens." Another agent presented Isser with a stuffed toy tiger cub as a souvenir of the operation. His colleagues shipped to his home in Tel Aviv Yosela's bed, on which he had passed so many sleepless nights. Now that the boy had been found, the whole truth came to light. It had all started with a telegram. In the spring of 1960, while Yosela was being clandestinely shuttled from one yeshiva to another in Israel, Ruth Ben David received a telegram from her friend Rabbi Mezish. "Come immediately to Jerusalem. I have a good match for you." When Ruth arrived, she found out that the match was actually a secret mission to smuggle Yosela out of Israel. Ruth returned to France, altered her passport, changing the name of her son from Claude to Claudine and his date of birth from 1945 to 1953. She then changed her clothes and her name, becoming Madeleine Ferraille. She flew to Genoa and bought a passage on a ship that sailed to Israel carrying passengers and new immigrants. On Genoa's dock, she began to play, as if by chance, with the 8-year-old daughter of a family of immigrants. When the boarding began and the immigrants were struggling with their packages and suitcases, the charming Madeleine took the little girl by the hand and led her up to the ship's deck. The Italian immigration officers checked her passport and noted that she had got on board with her little girl. In Israel, she repeated the same procedure, and the Israeli immigration duly noted that she had come out of the boat with her little daughter. A few days later, Madeleine Ferrai boarded a plane at Lode Airport with her daughter Claudine, who was none other than Josela Schuchmacher, wearing a neat girl's dress and patent leather pumps. Josela spent almost 2 years in ultra-Orthodox boarding schools in Switzerland and France. But when the search for Josela in Israel reached a larger scale, Madeleine showed up at the boarding school in Mo, where the child was hidden now under the guise of Menachem, an orphan of Swiss parentage. She dressed him in girl's clothes once again and flew with him to America. There she was helped by the head of the Satmar sect, Rabbi Joel Teitelbaum, who directed a milkman named Gertner to take Yankala to his home and pass him off as a cousin from Argentina who had come for a long visit. The Mossad experts realized that the ultra-Orthodox clandestine network spread all over America and Europe was comparable to the secret organizations of the world's best intelligence services. And most of all, they were amazed by Ruth Ben-David. She stuck to the rules of conspiracy. She never had a permanent address, carried all her important papers in her handbag, changed identities as easily as one changes one's clothes. The lovely French woman was the Mata Hari of the Orthodox world. But while all of Israel was rejoicing over the return of Josela to his parents, Ruth Ben-David felt broken and vanquished. "I am guilty," she said to her friends, sobbing. "I betrayed our cause. I can never forgive myself. I had a precious treasure entrusted to me, and I could not keep it." Yet Madeleine Ferrai, Ruth Ben-David, had so admirably demonstrated all the qualities necessary for a secret agent that Isser Harel decided to offer her a job at the Mossad. But he was too late. Ruth returned to Jerusalem and vanished in the ultra-Orthodox world. 3 years later, she married Rabbi Amram Blau, the 72-year-old head of the most fanatical of all sects, Naturei Karta. Isser Harel and Josela Schuchmacher met only 9 years later, when one of the authors of this book threw a party in Isser's honor and invited Josela. Josela, now a private first class in a tank division, shook hands with Isser and declared, "I am deeply touched. Isser Harel has been the most important person in my life. Without him, I would not be here among you." Chapter 8. A Nazi Hero at the Service of the Mossad. On a stifling hot day in August 1963, two men entered the offices of an engineering company in Madrid and asked to meet the owner, an Austrian by the name of Otto Skorzeny. They introduced themselves to Skorzeny as NATO intelligence officers and told him they had come on the recommendation of his estranged wife. They had for him an offer he couldn't refuse. Very soon, the respectable businessman realized that his visitors knew all about him and his past. During World War II, SS officer Skorzeny had been one of the great heroes, if not the greatest, of Nazi Germany. A tall, charismatic athlete, his face scarred in a fencing duel, he had become a daredevil commando officer who carried out spectacular operations. On September 12, 1943, he had landed with a paratrooper battalion carried by gliders on top of the Gran Sasso, the highest peak in the Italian Apennines, and stormed the Campo Imperator Hotel, where former fascist dictator Benito Mussolini had been jailed by a new anti-Nazi Italian government. SS Captain Skorzeny rescued Mussolini and brought him to a grateful Hitler, who showered Skorzeny with medals and promotions. In the Battle of the Bulge in late 1944, Skorzeny, now a Waffen-SS colonel, snuck through the front lines with 24 of his men dressed as American soldiers and caused disorder and confusion in the Allied ranks. His operations earned him the reputation of the most dangerous man in Europe. Found not guilty at the Dachau trials after the war, he moved to Spain, where he enjoyed the protection of fascist dictator Franco and established his company. His visitors that day in 1963 didn't waste time on small talk. "We are not exactly from NATO," one of them admitted in perfect German. "Actually, we belong to the Israeli Secret Services." The two men were Rafi Eitan and the head of the Mossad station in Germany, Avraham Ahituv. Skorzeny paled. Barely a year ago, the Israelis had hanged Adolf Eichmann. Were they after him now? He had been cleared at the war trials, but some claimed that he had taken part in burning Jewish synagogues during Kristallnacht in November 1938. But the short man sitting in front of him dispelled his fears. "We need your help," he said. "We know you have good connections in Egypt." He then proceeded to tell the SS colonel why the Jewish state needed his assistance. On July 21, 1962, only 2 weeks after the triumphant return of Yosela to Israel, Egypt amazed the world by launching 4 missiles. 2 were of the Al-Zafir, the Victor, type, with a range of 175 miles, and 2 of the Al-Kahir, the Conqueror, type, with a range of 350 miles. The huge missiles, draped in Egypt's flags, were proudly paraded in the streets of Cairo on Revolution Day, July 23rd. President Gamal Abdel Nasser boasted to an ecstatic crowd that his missiles were capable of hitting any target south of Beirut. South of Beirut, Israel's leaders were seized with astonishment and anxiety. Nasser's missiles could indeed hit any target in Israel. That came as a complete surprise to Israel, and in the corridors of power, angry words were addressed to Isser Harel. While Nasser was building his deadly rockets, the critics said, little Isser was busy chasing Yosela. While terrible dangers threatened the very existence of the Jewish state, Isser's best agents were running from one yeshiva to another, disguised as ultra-Orthodox Jews. A worried Ben-Gurion summoned Isser Harel, who promised to get all the information about the Egyptian project as soon as possible. Back at his headquarters, Isser sent his best men on a mission and activated his moles and informants in Egypt. And indeed, on August 16th, less than a month after the launching of the 4 missiles, he came back to Ben-Gurion with a detailed report. The missiles were being built by German scientists, Isser reported. In 1959, Nasser had decided to establish a secret arsenal of unconventional weapons. He had appointed General Mahmoud Khalil, a former Air Force intelligence commander, head of the Bureau for Special Military Programs, to develop these ultra-secret modern weapons, jet fighters, rockets, and missiles, as well as chemical and radioactive substances. The Bureau was allotted a huge budget. Khalil's first task was to find the men to make these weapons a reality, and he knew where to look. His agents started to recruit hundreds of German experts and scientists, most of whom had been employed in the rocket and aviation research institutes and testing grounds of Nazi Germany. More than 300 Germans, tempted by high salaries, bonuses, and myriad privileges, clandestinely trickled into Egypt and helped Nasser build 3 secret installations. The first was Factory 36, where genius aircraft builder Willy Messerschmitt was assembling an Egyptian jet fighter. Messerschmitt was the father of the deadly fighter planes of the Luftwaffe, the Nazi Air Force, during World War II. Mahmoud Khalil had signed a contract with him on November 29, 1959. In the second plant, known by the code 135, an engineer named Ferdinand Brandner was building jet engines for Messerschmitt's aircraft. Brandner had spent several years in Russia. After his return to Germany, Khalil had got in touch with him with the help of Dr. Eckhart, a director of Daimler-Benz. But the most secret was Factory 333, hidden in a remote area in the desert. There, Hitler's former Wunderkinds now built Nasser's wonder weapons, the intermediate-range missiles. According to Isser's sources, the Egyptian project had shifted to high gear in December 1960. That month, an American U-2 reconnaissance aircraft had photographed a huge building site in Dimona, Israel, that seemed to be a nuclear reactor. The world press announced the discovery with banner headlines. Nobody believed Israel's stilted statements that the structure was a textile factory. Egypt and several other Arab nations issued furious threats against Israel. But threats were not enough, and Egypt hoped to neutralize Israel's secret nuclear project by developing its own unconventional weapons. The head of the German rocket scientists in Egypt was Professor Eugen Senger, the director of the Institute of Research on Jet Propulsion in Stuttgart. After the war, Senger had spent a few years in France, where he built the Veronique rocket, a mediocre replica of the German V-2 rocket. He came to Egypt with his assistants, Professor Paul Gerke, an electronics and guidance expert, and Wolfgang Pilz, formerly an engineer at the Peenemünde installation, where the brilliant Werner von Braun had developed Nazi Germany's V-2 rockets. Another guidance and control expert closely collaborating with his colleagues in Egypt was Dr. Heinz Kleinwachter, whose lab for developing missile guidance systems was in the picturesque German city of Lörrach, close to the Swiss border. The chemistry department was headed by Dr. Ermin Dadieu, a former SS officer. The Germans and the Egyptians established several front companies, Intra, Intrahandel, Patwak, and Linda, that purchased parts and materials for the missile project. The administrative director of Intrahandel was Dr. Heinz Krug, who also managed the Institute for Jet Propulsion in Stuttgart. Hassan Kamel, an Egyptian millionaire living in Switzerland, was also enlisted as a facade and liaison man. With his help, the Egyptians established two dummy companies in Switzerland, MECO, Mechanical Corporation, and MTP, Motors, Turbines, and Pumps, whose task was to acquire basic materials, electrical apparatuses, and precision tools. They also recruited specialists and experts. The three directors of these companies were Messerschmitt, Brandner, and Kamel. In 1961, Senger and many hundreds of engineers, technicians, and local Egyptian employees had started building the Egyptian missiles. But at the end of that year, the German government discovered the secret connection between the Egyptian project and the Institute for Jet Propulsion in Stuttgart. The German authorities forced Senger to resign, return to Germany, and cease all activity. Professor Pilz succeeded him as head of the Egyptian project. By July 1962, Factory 333 produced 30 missiles. Four of them were launched with great fanfare before a select crowd of government guests and journalists. 20 others, some of them dummies, draped with the Egyptian flag, were paraded through Cairo's streets. When Isser Harel came to Ben-Gurion in August, he produced a letter from Pilz to Kamel Azab, the Egyptian director of 333, which Rafi Eitan and his men had succeeded in copying. It was a request for 3,700,000 Swiss francs for machine parts and other equipment needed for building 500 missiles of Type 2 and 400 missiles of Type 5. 900 missiles. Isser's report caused deep anxiety in the defense community. The Israeli experts were certain that the Egyptians had no intention of loading the missiles' warheads with conventional explosives. They wouldn't have spent millions of dollars building them merely for the missiles to carry a half ton of dynamite. A bomber could do that with more precision. It was clear that Egypt would load the warheads with atomic bombs or some other substance forbidden by international law, such as poison gas, bacterial cultures, or deadly radioactive waste. According to Isser, the German scientists were working on a devious plan to destroy Israel. They were developing doomsday weapons, huge missiles, radioactive warheads that could kill any living thing and poison the air in Israel for many years. They were even working on death rays and other kinds of hellish contraptions. "We took them too seriously," General Zvi Zur, the chief of staff at the time, admitted later.
Our scientists were amateurs and didn't know how to handle the information. Still, the Israelis discovered the Achilles heel of the Egyptian project. The Germans hadn't succeeded yet in developing a proper guidance system to direct the missiles to their targets. As long as that obstacle wasn't overcome, the missiles couldn't be used. Isser Harel was no longer the same man his people knew and admired. Since Eichmann's capture, he had undergone a profound change. This cool-headed man, who was known for his nerves of steel, now regarded Germany as the eternal enemy of Israel and the Jewish people. He staunchly believed that the current German government was supporting the scientists in Egypt and secretly helping them in their efforts to destroy Israel. The Ramsad asked Ben-Gurion to alert Germany's Chancellor Konrad Adenauer and demand that he act immediately to stop the scientists' activities. Ben-Gurion refused. Quite recently, Germany had given Israel a huge loan of $500 million to develop the Negev Desert. Ben-Gurion and Adenauer had established personal relations of trust and mutual respect. Adenauer and his Minister of Defense, Franz Josef Strauss, supplied Israel with huge quantities of modern weapons worth hundreds of millions of dollars, tanks, cannons, helicopters, aircraft, all of this for free, in a secret effort to atone for the Holocaust and Germany's crimes against the Jewish people. Ben-Gurion trusted the current German government and didn't want to jeopardize Israel's relations with it by hurling accusations and demands to intervene in the Egyptian crisis. He instructed Deputy Minister of Defense Shimon Peres to write a personal letter to Strauss and discreetly ask for his help. But this wasn't enough for Isser, who decided to launch his own all-out campaign to disrupt the Germans' activities in Egypt. On September 11, 1962, at 10:30 a.m., a swarthy stranger with a Middle Eastern cast to his features entered the Intra offices on Munich's Schillerstrasse. The clerk who ushered him into the office of the company director, Dr. Heinz Krug, heard him say he had been sent by Colonel Nadim, an Egyptian officer who maintained close contacts with Krug. Half an hour later, the Egyptian left the building with Krug. A United Arab Airlines stewardess saw the two men go by the airline ticket office. She was the last person to see Krug. The following morning, Mrs. Krug informed the police that her husband was missing. 2 days later, the police found Krug's white Mercedes abandoned on the outskirts of Munich. The car was covered with mud, and its tank was bone dry. An anonymous phone call to the police announced, "Dr. Krug is dead." But some information from other sources made the police believe that Krug had been abducted by Mossad agents and taken to Israel. Today, there is no more doubt that Krug is dead. On November 27th, Hannelore Wende, Pilz's secretary at Factory 333, saw a thick envelope in the morning mail. The sender was a well-known Hamburg lawyer. Hannelore opened the package. A deafening explosion shook the office. Gravely wounded, Pilz's secretary was taken to the hospital, where she was to spend a few months before leaving blind, deaf, her face badly scarred. The next day, a big package marked books arrived at Factory 333. When an Egyptian clerk opened it, the package exploded, killing five people. The sender's address, a Stuttgart publisher, turned out to be false. The explosive packages kept arriving the following days. Some of them had been sent from Germany, others from inside Egypt. Some blew up, causing casualties. Others were diffused by Egyptian army experts alerted by 333 officials. The identity of the senders wasn't officially established, but the Egyptians and the journalists were certain that the bombs were prepared and sent to Cairo by the Israeli Mossad. Much later, it was established that several of the letter bombs had been mailed by the Champagne spy. This was an Israeli agent, Ze'ev Gur Ariyeh, who operated in Egypt under the cover of Wolfgang Lutz, a German owner of a horse farm near Cairo. Posing as a former SS officer, He had settled in Cairo with his German wife and established close relations with Egypt's high society and its military leaders. The letter bombs deeply disturbed the German scientists, who now felt their lives were in danger. Many of them got anonymous phone calls threatening them or their families if they kept working on Nasser's project. Strict security measures were applied at the three factories in Egypt and at the sister companies in Europe. When visiting Europe, the scientists had to move in large groups, accompanied by German security officers. This practice probably saved Professor Pilz on his trip to Europe in late 1962. A group of strangers followed him in Germany and Italy, but didn't get the opportunity to come near him. Isser spent the fall and winter of 1962 in Europe, directing several Mossad operations intended to obtain more accurate and updated information. Rafi Eitan succeeded in penetrating a diplomatic mission that handled the German scientists' mail. Such operations were his favorite. "That's much better than recruiting agents," he said. "When you recruit an agent, you have to train him, build him a foolproof cover, put him in place, and give him time to establish contacts. But reading your enemy's mail is much better. You get immediate results and first-class material." For his unconventional operations, Eitan needed some very sophisticated electronic equipment, but did not know where to get it. The equipment, used by the CIA and other intelligence agencies, could not be found in stores. While reading his newspaper in his Paris office, Eitan noticed a short item about the notorious Jewish mobster Meyer Lansky, who was the mob boss of Miami. In his scheming mind, that seemed like an opportunity. He called the operator. "Find Meyer Lansky in Miami." 3 minutes later, Lansky was on the line.
"Shalom, Meyer," Eitan said. "I am an Israeli operating in Paris, and I need your help for the Zionist state."
"No problem," Lansky answered. "In a month I shall be in Lausanne in Switzerland. Let's meet there."
Eitan met with Lansky in Lausanne and told him what he needed. Lansky gave him the address of a certain man in Chicago.
"He'll get you what you want," he said.
A week later, Eitan landed in Chicago and headed for the man's address.
"The electronic equipment we got from this guy served us well all through our operations against the German scientists," Eitan summed up.
One of these operations brought a new name to Isser Harel: Dr. Otto Jaklick. According to the source material, Jaklick was an Austrian scientist specializing in nuclear radiation. Dr. Jaklick was allegedly employed by a top-secret Egyptian project to obtain nuclear weapons in record time. The Egyptians intended to establish a front company, Ostra, for Jaklick in Austria, which would purchase radioactive materials for Jaklick's project and ship them to Egypt. Ostra would be separate from Intra to avoid being investigated by the German authorities. Jaklick was to carry out two nuclear tests for Egypt and produce several atom bombs that would be fitted into the missiles' warheads. All this indicated that Jaklick was a very dangerous man, perhaps the most dangerous of the German scientists. An urgent order was sent to all the Mossad stations in Europe: find Jaklick. But Isser was in for a stunning surprise. On October 23, 1962, a stranger rang the door of an Israeli embassy in Europe and asked to see the security officer.
"My name is Otto Jaklick. I am ready to give you a full report about my activity for the Egyptian war effort."
2 weeks later, in utter secrecy, Jaklick landed in Israel. Many months later, when the Jaklick defection came to light, European reporters wrote that Jaklick probably contacted the Israelis because of the disappearance of Intra director Heinz Krug. Jaklick had maintained close contact with Krug, who was among the few in the know of Jaklick's role in Egypt's special military programs. When Krug disappeared, Jaklick panicked. What if Krug had been abducted by the Israelis? He might talk and reveal Jaklick's secret tasks. And then Jaklick knew he was as good as dead. Therefore, he decided to cross the lines and surrender to the Israelis. That way, he hoped, he at least would save his life. Yaklik spent 4 days in Israel. He was kept in strict isolation in a top security facility of the Mossad. Isser decided to use him for 2 main tasks, as a source of intelligence about the Egyptian project and as a double agent who would return to Egypt and work there for the Mossad. Otto Yaklik told the Israelis that he had been recruited by a senior German clerk in the United Arab Airlines who introduced him to General Mahmoud Khalil, nicknamed by the German scientists Herr Doktor Mahmoud. His meeting with the Herr Doktor resulted in 2 projects, Ibis and Cleopatra. The secret of those projects was shared only with Professor Piltz and Dr. Krug. Operation Ibis was to provide Egypt with a radiological weapon that could spread dangerous nuclear radiation. Yaklik took it upon himself to obtain large quantities of radioactive isotope cobalt-60 and to experiment with it in Egypt. If the experiments succeeded, Yaklik would try getting more cobalt, which would be placed in the missile's warheads and spread deadly radiation on impact. The goal of the second project, Cleopatra, was to produce 2 atomic bombs. Yaklik suggested an ingenious method for manufacturing the bombs. Buying uranium enriched to 20% in the United States or in Europe, enriching it up to 90% by special centrifuges developed in Germany and Holland by the scientists Dr. Wilhelm Groth, Dr. Jakob Kistemacher, and Dr. Gernot Zippe, and building the bomb with the enriched uranium. Yaklik flew to the United States and tried to get the enriched uranium there. He also met with several German scientists and invited them to build centrifuges in Egypt. Simultaneously, he purchased some cobalt-60 in Europe and dispatched it to a gynecologist in Cairo, whose name was Dr. Khalil, the sister of Herr Dr. Mahmoud. When Yaklik's debriefing in Israel was over, his testimony was sent to several experts for review and assessment. For some reason, their reports didn't get the proper attention. Concerning the Cleopatra project, the experts said there were almost no chances that Yaklik would get 20% enriched uranium. Even if he did, Egypt would need at least 100 of the best centrifuges in order to harvest the necessary uranium for assembling 1 bomb within 2 to 3 years. And even if they managed to build a bomb, it wouldn't go off, for Yaklik's formulas were incorrect. The experts dismissed Ibis and the radiological weapons, whose impact, they said, would cause no more damage than an ordinary bomb. The soothing tone of the reports didn't calm the nation's leadership. They were even more alarmed by the reports that the Egyptians were also developing chemical weapons. On January 11, 1963, their fears were justified when the Egyptians used poison gas in their war in Yemen. Israeli Minister of Foreign Affairs Golda Meir met with President John F. Kennedy and talked to him about the danger that the Egyptians would arm their missiles with unconventional warheads. She asked him to intervene, but Kennedy did not. The unconventional warheads were indeed very dangerous, but the first priority was given to disrupting the development of the missile's guidance systems. In the winter of 1963, the Factory 333 guidance expert, Dr. Kleinwachter, was spending some weeks in Germany. On the evening of February 20th, he left his lab in Lorach and drove his car to the narrow lane leading to his home. The lane was dark and deserted, covered with deep snow. Suddenly, in a shrieking of tires, a car emerged from a cross street and blocked the way. A man got out of the car and walked toward Kleinwachter. The scientist glimpsed a third man in the car. "Where does Dr. Schenker live?" the man demanded. Without waiting for a reply, he drew a revolver equipped with a silencer and fired. The bullet shattered the windshield and lodged in the scientist's woolen muffler. Kleinwachter groped in the glove compartment for his own revolver, but his assailant ran back to a second car, which darted out of sight. The police found the first car abandoned about 100 yards from the scene of the attack. The three men had made their escape with another car. They had left behind a passport in the name of Ali Samir, one of the heads of the Egyptian Secret Service. It turned out, however, that this was a red herring. On the day of the attack, Samir was in Cairo and had been photographed with a German journalist. The men who had attacked Kleinwachter were never found, yet the unanimous opinion of the press was that the assassination attempt had been carried out by the Israelis and had ended in failure. A few weeks later, the Mossad tried again, this time going after German-born Dr. Paul Goerke in Switzerland. Goerke, like Kleinwachter, was working on a guidance system for the Egyptian missiles in his lab at Factory 333. He was deemed very important by the Egyptians and by the Mossad as well. His daughter Heidi lived in Freiburg, a German town close to the Swiss border. Shortly after the attempt on Kleinwachter's life, Dr. Jaklik called Heidi and told her that he had met her father in Egypt, where he was working on the development of terrible weapons intended to destroy Israel. Jaklik hinted that if Goerke didn't cease his activities, he would be exposing himself to frightful risks. If, on the other hand, he were to leave Egypt, he would not be harmed. "If you love your father," Jaklik concluded, "come on Saturday, March 2nd at 4 p.m. to the Three Kings Hotel in Basel, and I will introduce you to one of my friends." Heidi, scared, immediately contacted H. Mann, a former Nazi officer who had been charged by the Egyptians with the scientists' security. Mann alerted the Freiburg police, who notified the Swiss authorities. And so, when Jaklik and his friend entered the Three Kings Hotel, several police cars were waiting behind the building, detectives were stationed in the lobby, and tape recorders were installed close to the table where Heidi Goerke was sitting. Jaklik and his friend, Mossad agent Joseph Bengal, walked right into the trap. They suspected nothing and talked with Heidi Goerke for an hour, careful not to make any direct threats, but alluding to the danger for her father if he kept building his terrible weapons. They offered Heidi a plane ticket to Cairo so that she could persuade her father to return to Germany, where he and his family would be safe. The meeting over, the two men left the hotel and took the 6 o'clock train to Zurich, where they went their separate ways. But while Jaklik was waiting for another train on the platform, he was arrested by plainclothes policemen. Bengal was apprehended near the Israeli consulate. That evening, the German police asked the Swiss to extradite the two men who were suspected of threatening Heidi Goerke and also of having participated in the attack on Dr. Kleinwachter. From his headquarters in Europe, Isser activated his contacts and tried to persuade the Swiss to release Bengal and Jaklik, but they refused because of the German extradition request. Isser then flew back to Israel and met with Minister of Foreign Affairs Golda Meir. Lately, they had become very close and shared the same hostility and suspicions toward Germany. Golda suggested that Israel approach Chancellor Adenauer and demand that West Germany withdraw the extradition request. Isser immediately drove to Tiberias, where Prime Minister Ben-Gurion was vacationing. He urged Ben-Gurion to send a special envoy to Bonn, West Germany's capital. The envoy would present Adenauer with proof of the atrocious activities of the German scientists in Egypt and demand the withdrawal of the extradition request. Ben-Gurion refused. Isser didn't let go. "You have to decide what to do if the arrest is made public. Then the entire affair will blow up." "What do you mean, blow up?" Ben-Gurion asked. "As soon as Bengal's arrest becomes known, the entire affair of the German scientists in Egypt will also come to light. Israel will have to explain why Bengal acted as he did. We shall also have to disclose that the Egyptians have been buying equipment for their rockets and other military projects from Germany." Ben-Gurion thought a moment and finally said, "So be it." That was the beginning of the rift between the two men. In the evening of Thursday, March 15, 1963, United Press International announced the arrest of Jaklik and Bengal on suspicion of having threatened the daughter of a German scientist in the employ of Egypt. Isser Harel called a secret meeting with the editors-in-chief of the daily newspapers. At the meeting, he described the background to Bengal's arrest. He particularly stressed Jaklik's part in the affair, the kind of work he had been doing for the Egyptian project, and the fact that he changed sides voluntarily and was trying to repair the damage. During the next few days, Isser's aides secretly briefed three Israeli journalists, Naftali Lavi of Haaretz, Shmuel Segev of Ma'ariv, and Yeshayahu ben Porat of Yediot Aranot. They were given all the facts and the addresses of Intra, Patvag, and the Stuttgart Institute. The three men then left for Europe to gather data on the German scientists and cable it to their papers in Israel. News about the German scientists' project would be more credible coming from Europe, Isser thought. Other Mossad men were sent abroad to brief pro-Israeli journalists. Isser Harel didn't realize that the German issue was one of the most sensitive topics in Israel. His unbridled attack on Germany started an avalanche that couldn't be stopped, a deluge of accusations against the scientists that provoked real panic in Israel. By March 17th, the Israeli and foreign press were floundering in a sea of sensational headlines. German scientists, most of them former Nazis, were producing deadly weapons in Egypt. They were preparing biological, chemical, nuclear, and radioactive weapons. They were developing poison gas, terrible germs, death rays, warheads equipped with atomic bombs or radioactive waste that would spread lethal radiation. The newspapers competed with one another by publishing reports that seemed plagiarized from the Flash Gordon comics. The death ray, hissing and scorching everything in its path. The air over Israel that would be poisoned for 90 years at least. The germs spreading atrocious plagues, etc. The campaign also accused the government of the Federal Republic of Germany of refraining from putting an end to the devilish activities of its subjects working for Egypt and actually following in Hitler's footsteps. The reporters sent to Europe added more fat to the fire by discovering every day new details about the scientists' diabolical plot. Bengal and Jaklik's trial in Basel ended with light sentences for the two men, 2 months in jail, with time served. But it had a secondary result with enormous implications. During the trial, the judge suddenly noticed that one of the spectators was carrying a gun. "How dare you carry a gun in my court?" he indignantly asked. The man answered, "I have a permit to carry a weapon at all times. I am the security officer of the German scientists in Egypt." He identified himself as H. Mann, the man who has been contacted by Heidi Gurka after Jaklik's phone call and who actually had alerted the German police. An undercover Mossad informant left the courtroom at once and reported the incident to his superiors. As he heard the report, veteran Mossad agent Rafi Medan jumped aboard the first train to Vienna and hurried to the home of the famous Nazi hunter, Simon Wiesenthal. Wiesenthal immediately agreed to help the Mossad. "Do you know anything about a German named H. Mann?" Medan asked. Wiesenthal went to work in his overflowing archives. After a few hours, he returned to Medan with a file in his hands. "He was an SS officer during the war," he said. "He served in a commando unit under Colonel Otto Skorzeny." Medan brought the information to the omnipresent Rafi Eitan and to Avraham Ahituv. A balding, sunburned man with mustache and glasses, Ahituv was born in Germany as Avraham Gottfried and immigrated with his religious parents to Israel at the age of 5. At 16, he already was a member of the Haganah, and at 18, one of the founders of the Shabak. Extremely intelligent, he had completed his studies during his service and graduated from law school summa cum laude. In 1955, he had caught the most important Egyptian spy in Israel, Rifaat el-Gamal, who operated under the Israeli identity of Jack Bitton. Ahituv turned el-Gamal, making him one of the Mossad's best double agents, who fed the Egyptians expertly doctored information for more than 12 years. In 1967, on the eve of the Six-Day War, el-Gamal would inform the Egyptians that Israel would launch a ground attack before sending its aircraft into battle. The resulting laxity of the Egyptian Air Force facilitated its destruction on the ground by the Israeli jets. In the future, Ahituv would become one of the best Shabak directors, mostly appreciated for his efforts to integrate Israeli Arabs into the mainstream of Israel's society. On this evening in May 1963, Ahituv listened to Maidan's report about Mann and Skorzeny, then turned to Eitan. "Why don't we try to recruit Skorzeny?" The idea seemed bizarre at first, but it had its inner logic. If Skorzeny turned on Mann, he had a chance to obtain highly classified material from his former subordinate. Now, the question was how to contact Skorzeny. A quick check revealed that Skorzeny's estranged wife had stayed very close to him. She was now managing a company that specialized in metal trading. The Mossad agents found an Israeli businessman, Shlomo Zabludovich, who was in the same line of business, and contacted him. "Yes," he said, "he knew Ms. Skorzeny." He introduced them to the lady, who told them all they needed to know. That was how Eitan and Ahituv showed up in Skorzeny's office in Madrid. They now asked the former Third Reich hero to become their agent and provide the Mossad with information about the activities of the German scientists in Egypt. Besides H. Mann, Skorzeny knew quite a few leaders of the German community in Egypt, many of whom were his former fellow officers. "How can I trust you?" Skorzeny asked. "How can I be sure that you won't go after me later?" He feared that Israeli Avengers would find him as they found Eichmann, and his fate would be the same. Rafi Eitan found the solution right away. "We are authorized to offer you freedom from fear," he said. He took a sheet of paper and wrote Skorzeny a letter in the name of the State of Israel, which guaranteed him freedom from fear and assured him that he would not be subject to any kind of persecution or violence. Skorzeny perused the document, then fell silent. He got up and paced back and forth, immersed in thought. He finally turned to the Israelis. "I agree," he said. In the following months, Skorzeny brought to his Mossad handlers priceless intelligence about the activities of the German scientists in Egypt. With the help of H. Mann and his other former cohorts, he obtained detailed lists of the German scientists and their addresses, reports about the progress of their projects, plans, and blueprints of the missiles, correspondence about the failures to assemble a guidance system for the missiles. But Isser Harel wasn't there anymore to read Skorzeny's reports. In the meantime, the Israeli media had been set loose. Shrieking headlines, editorials, cartoons, and even poems announced that Germany of 1963 was the same as Germany of 1933, and the same Germany that had massacred 6 million Jews was now helping Egypt prepare a new Holocaust. In the Knesset, opposition leader Menachem Begin shouted at Ben-Gurion in an inflammatory tirade, "You are selling Uzis to the Germans and they are sending germs to our enemies." In a speech, Isser's ally Golda Meir accused the Germans in Egypt of producing weapons whose aim is to destroy all living things. These accusations were exaggerated, almost totally detached from reality. Amos Manner, head of the Shabak and a close friend of Isser, would tell us later, "During this period, when Isser directed the campaign against the German scientists, he was an unbalanced man. It was much deeper than obsession. You couldn't have a normal conversation on this subject with him. Deputy Minister of Defense Shimon Peres, who returned to Israel on March 24th from a trip to Africa, immediately perceived the tremendous danger that could arise from Isser Harel's crusade. He also realized that the stories about the weapons that kill any living thing were simply ludicrous. Aman, the IDF's intelligence branch, presented him with a totally different estimate. "We gathered all that we could collect," said the IDF intelligence chief, General Meir Amit, and slowly a picture emerged. This story had been blown out of any proportion. Our people said that this couldn't be true. It couldn't be something serious. Amit's people didn't find any indication that the German scientists were developing chemical or bacteriological weapons. The stories about doomsday weapons seemed borrowed from science fiction. The quantities of cobalt brought to Egypt were infinitesimal. It was also established that Dr. Otto Jaklik, whose testimony had played a major part in the whole business, was no more than an opportunist who could not be trusted. The Amman report reached Ben-Gurion's desk on March 24th. He immediately summoned Isser Harel and questioned him about his sources. He demanded full and accurate answers. Isser admitted having sent reporters to Europe after a thorough briefing. He also admitted that he had no information about poison gas, radiology, or cobalt bombs. The next day, Ben-Gurion met with Shimon Peres, who came with the chief of staff and General Amit. The Amman chief made a detailed report that painted a clear picture. The scientists working in Egypt were mediocre, and they were building obsolete missiles. Their activities were dangerous indeed, but the panic that had spread in the governing circles in Israel, including the Ministry of Defense and the IDF, was utterly out of proportion. Ben-Gurion summoned Isser again. Their conversation was tense, and Ben-Gurion expressed doubts as to the accuracy of Isser's reports and assessments. The total trust that characterized the relations between the two men was replaced by an angry debate that also touched upon the other aspects of German-Israeli relations. Isser, furious, returned to his office and dispatched a letter of resignation to Ben-Gurion. Ben-Gurion tried to talk him out of leaving, but Isser was adamant. "I resign," he said, "and that's final." This was the end of an era. Ben-Gurion then asked Isser to stay until a replacement was found. Isser refused. "Tell Ben-Gurion to send somebody right away and take the keys," he said to Ben-Gurion's secretary. The prime minister had to find a replacement for the legendary Ramsad right away. "Get me Amos Manner at once," he said to his secretary, who rushed to the telephone. But the head of the Shabak was unreachable. He was on his way to Kibbutz Ma'agan in the Jordan Valley to visit relatives, and cell phones had yet to be invented. "Then get me Meir," Ben-Gurion said impatiently. General Meir Amit was on a tour of inspection in the Negev, but was reached by radio and summoned to Tel Aviv. On his arrival, he learned that he was being appointed acting Mossad director until a new chief took charge of the organization. A few weeks later, Amit's appointment became final. Following Peres's discreet letter to Franz Josef Strauss, Germany charged a respected expert, Professor Böhm, to devise the means of bringing back the scientists from Egypt. Germany indeed succeeded in tempting many of the scientists by offering them employment in research institutions on its territory. The others gradually left Egypt. They didn't finish building missiles, their navigation systems failed, the missile warheads were not filled with radioactive materials, and even Messerschmitt's plane never took off. One of the authors of this book traveled to Huntsville, Alabama, and met there with NASA's blue-eyed boy, Dr. Werner von Braun. Von Braun went over the lists of German scientists in Egypt and their alleged projects, and concluded that there were very slim chances that these second-rate scientists would have ever been able to build effective missiles. Herr Dr. Mahmoud's Egyptian endeavor ended in complete failure. The affair of the German scientists brought about the fall of Isser Harel and the rise of Meir Amit. Harel developed a deep loathing toward his successor and bitterly fought him during his years as Ramsad. The affair of the German scientists also undermined Ben-Gurion's political power, and he resigned from office a few months later. In Cairo, the Egyptian secret services unmasked Wolfgang Lutz, the Champagne spy, and arrested him in 1965. Yet they failed to crack his German cover. He was sentenced only to jail and released after 2.5 years. The end of the affair was also the end of the Mossad's work with Otto Skorzeny, the most improbable agent who ever spied for the Jewish state. Chapter 9. Our Man in Damascus. My dear Nadia, my dear family, I am writing to you these last words, hoping that you'll remain united forever. I ask my wife to forgive me, to take care of herself, and give a good education to our children. My dearest Nadia, you may remarry so that our children will have a father. You are absolutely free in that respect. I ask you not to mourn the past, but turn to the future. I am sending you my last kisses. Please pray for my soul. Yours, Eli. This letter reached the desk of the new Ramsad, Meir Amit, in May 1965. Eli Cohen, one of the boldest spies in the history of espionage, had written it with a trembling hand just a few minutes before his life came to an abrupt end on the gallows of Damascus. The secret life of Eli Cohen had begun more than 20 years before. A young, handsome Egyptian Jew, Cohen was on his way home one humid afternoon in mid-July 1954. He was 30, of medium height, sporting a neat black mustache and a disarming smile. On a Cairo street, he bumped into an old friend, a police officer. "Tonight we'll arrest some Israeli terrorists," the officer confided. "One of them is called Shmuel Azar." Eli faked awe and admiration, but as soon as he parted with his friend, he ran to his rented apartment and removed the handgun, the explosives, and the documents he kept there. Eli was deeply involved in clandestine activities. He planned escape routes and prepared false documents for Jewish families that wanted to emigrate to Israel. He also was a member of the Jewish underground, responsible for an ambitious operation known as the Lavon Affair. In early 1954, Israel's leaders learned that the British government had decided to pull out of Egypt completely. Egypt was the strongest of the Arab countries and a sworn enemy of Israel. As long as the British army was present in Egypt and maintained scores of army bases and military airfields along the Suez Canal, Israel could count on its moderating influence over the military junta that governed the country. With the decision to evacuate Egypt, that influence would evaporate at once. Besides, modern bases, airfields, and huge stores of equipment and war materials would fall in the hands of the Egyptian army. Israel, then only 6 years old, could be the target of an aggressive attack by a larger, better-equipped Egyptian army that wanted to avenge its shameful defeat in the 1948 Israel Independence War. Could the British decision be revoked? Ben-Gurion was not at the helm of Israel anymore. He had retired to Kibbutz Sedeh Boker. He had been replaced by a moderate but weak leader, Moshe Sharet. Minister of Defense Pinchas Lavon openly disputed Sharet's authority. Without Sharet's knowledge, and without informing the Mossad, Lavon and Colonel Benjamin Gibli, the head of military intelligence, Amman, concocted a dangerous and foolish plan. They found a clause in the British-Egyptian agreement that allowed Great Britain to return to its former bases in case of a grave crisis, and naively concluded that if several terrorist bombings were to sweep Egypt, Britain would conclude that Egypt's leaders couldn't maintain law and order. Therefore, the British would cancel their decision to pull out of the country. Lavon and Ghibli decided to carry out several bombings in Cairo and Alexandria, targeting American and British libraries and cultural centers, cinemas, post offices, and other public buildings. Amman's secret agents in Egypt recruited some young local Jews, fervent Zionists, who were ready to give their lives for Israel. By doing that, Amman broke a sacrosanct rule of Israel's intelligence community. Never use local Jews in hostile operations, as that could cost them their lives and place the entire Jewish community in grave danger. In addition, the young men and women had no preliminary training for such operations. The bombs were rudimentary, made out of eyeglass cases in which a chemical substance had been placed. Another substance was poured into a condom introduced into the case. Highly corrosive, the chemical would burn its way through the condom and come into contact with the other substance inside the case, producing a minor burst of fire. The condom was used as a timing tool to allow the person placing the incendiary device to escape before the explosion. The plan was doomed from the start. On July 23rd, after a couple of minor operations, one of the bombs exploded in the pocket of Philip Natanen, a member of the Zionist network, at the entrance of Cinema Rio in Alexandria. He was arrested by the police, and in the following days, all the network members were caught. Eli Cohen was arrested as well, but the search of his apartment failed to discover any incriminating evidence. He was released, but the Egyptian police opened a file on him. It included three photos and the record of Eli Shaul Yundi Cohen, born in 1924 in Alexandria, to Shaul and Sophie Cohen, who had emigrated to an unknown destination in 1949 with Eli's two sisters and five brothers. The suspect was a graduate of the French College and a student at the Cairo Farouk University. The Egyptians didn't know that Eli's family had emigrated to Israel and settled in Bat Yam, a suburb of Tel Aviv. In spite of the arrests, Eli decided to stay in Egypt and not run away. Fearing the worst for his friends, he collected every bit of information about their incarceration, beatings, and torture in Egypt's jail. In October, the Egyptians publicly announced the arrest of Israeli spies, and on December 7th, their trial opened in Cairo. Max Bennett, an Israeli undercover agent who was arrested with the group, killed himself by cutting his wrists with a rusty nail he had pulled out of his cell door. At the trial, the prosecution asked for the death penalty for some of the detainees. Pleas for mercy streamed from the papal nuncio, the French foreign minister, the U.S. and Great Britain's ambassadors, members of the British House of Commons, Richard Crossman, and Maurice Auerbach, the chief rabbi of Egypt. All was in vain. On January 17, 1955, the extraordinary military court announced the sentences. Two of the accused were found not guilty. Two were sentenced to 7 years of prison with hard labor, two to 15 years, and two to life. The two leaders of the network, Dr. Moshe Marzouk and the engineer Shmuel Azar, were sentenced to death and hanged 4 days later in the courtyard of Cairo prison. In Israel, a tremendous political scandal shook the government. Who had given the stupid criminal order for that operation? Several boards of inquiry failed to reach a clear-cut answer. Lavon and Ghibli pointed fingers at each other. Minister of Defense Lavon was forced to resign and was replaced by Ben-Gurion, who came back from retirement. Colonel Ghibli was never promoted and after a short while had to leave the army. In Egypt, Eli Cohen had lost some of his best friends. Although still a suspect in the eyes of the authorities, he stayed in Cairo and pursued his clandestine activities. Only in 1957, after the Suez War, did he immigrate to Israel. The Cairo Martyrs is the name of a quiet, shady street in Bat Yam. Eli walked that street every day when coming to visit his family. His first steps in Israel were not easy. For a few weeks, he was looking for a job. Thanks to his fluency in languages, Arabic, French, English, and even Hebrew, he found a position, translating weekly and monthly magazines for Amman. His office on a Tel Aviv street was camouflaged as a commercial agency. Eli was paid a modest salary, 170 Israeli pounds, $95 a month. After a few months, he was fired. One of his friends, also an Egyptian Jew, found him a new job, accountant at the department store chain Hamashbir. The job was boring, but the pay was higher. At that time, his brother introduced him to a pretty, smart young nurse of Iraqi origin. A month after meeting her, Eli wed Nadia, the sister of a rising intellectual, Sami Michael. One morning, a man walked into Ali's office. "My name is Zalman," he said. "I am an intelligence officer. I want to offer you a job."
"What kind of job?"
"Quite interesting, actually. You'll travel to Europe a lot. Perhaps you'll even have to go to Arab countries as our agent." Eli refused.
"I just got married," he said. "I don't want to travel to Europe or to any other place."
That was the end of the conversation, but not the end of the affair. Nadia got pregnant and had to leave her job. Hamashbir had to restructure and fired a few employees, Eli among them. He couldn't find another job. And then, as if by chance, an unexpected visitor knocked on the door of his rented apartment. It was Zalman again.
"Why do you refuse to work for us?" he asked Eli.
"We shall pay you £350, $195, a month. You'll train for 6 months, then if you like it, you'll stay. If not, you'll be free to go." This time, Eli didn't say no, and he became a secret agent. Some of the Amman veterans tell a different version. They maintain that when he arrived in Israel, Eli didn't get a job at Amman because the psychological tests he underwent showed him to be overconfident. He was gifted, courageous, and had an excellent memory, but had the tendency to overestimate himself and take unnecessary risks. These character traits, combined, made him unsuitable for Amman. But in the early 60s, things changed. Amman's Unit 131, the Special Operations Unit of the IDF Intelligence Branch, urgently started looking for a highly qualified agent in Damascus, the capital of Syria. In the last few years, Syria had become the most aggressive Arab country and the sworn enemy of Israel. It never missed a chance to attack. Syria confronted Israel in bloody battles at the Golan Heights and on the shores of the Lake of Galilee. It dispatched squads of terrorists across the Israeli border, and now it planned to carry out a grandiose engineering project intended to divert the waters of the Jordan River tributaries and deprive Israel of water. In the late 50s, Israel had launched a project of huge pipelines and canals that would carry a part of the Jordan water to the arid Negev region. The water was taken from the part of the river that passed through Israel's territory. The water project triggered a series of Arab summit conferences. The Arab nations solemnly decided to divert the Jordan tributaries and kill the Israeli project. The job itself fell to Syria. Israel could not survive without Jordan's water. It could not let Syria succeed and started planning a response. It needed an agent in Damascus, somebody trustworthy, confident, and daring. The same characteristics that had forced Amman to reject Ali before made him perfect now for Unit 131. 50 years later, it was revealed that Aman had tried to recruit somebody else for that job, Sami Michael, Nadia Cohen's brother. Michael refused, stayed in Israel, and became one of its great poets. Cohen's training was long and exhausting. Every morning, under some pretext, Eli would leave home and head for the Aman Training Center. For several weeks, he had only one instructor, a man named Yitzhak. First, he learned how to memorize things. Yitzhak would throw a dozen objects on the table. A pencil, a bunch of keys, a cigarette, an eraser, a few pins. Eli glanced at them for a second or two. Then he had to close his eyes and describe what they looked like. He also learned to identify the type and make of tanks, aircrafts, and cannons. "Let's go for a walk," Yitzhak would say. The two of them would stroll in the crowded Tel Aviv streets. "Do you see the newspaper stand over there?" Yitzhak would whisper. "Now go there and pretend to be looking at the papers, but at the same time try to find out who is following you." When they returned to the center, Yitzhak would listen to Ali's report and then throw a batch of photos on the table. "You were right about this one. He followed you indeed, but what about that one by the tree? He was also shadowing you." One morning, Zalman introduced him to another instructor, Yehuda, who taught him how to use a small, sophisticated radio transmitter. He then sent Ali to undergo physical exams and psychological tests. After the tests were over, Zalman introduced Ali to a young woman, Marcel Cousin. "It's time for the decisive test, Ali," he said. "Marcel will give you a French passport in the name of an Egyptian Jew who has immigrated to Africa and now has come to Israel as a tourist. With this passport, you'll go to Jerusalem and stay there 10 days. Marcel will give you full details about your cover, your past in Egypt, your family, your work in Africa. In Jerusalem, you'll only speak French and Arabic. You have to meet people, make friends, and establish new contacts without revealing your real identity. You must also make sure that you're not followed." Eli spent 10 days in Jerusalem. On his return, he got a few days of leave. Nadia had just given birth to a daughter, Sophie. After Rosh Hashanah, the Jewish New Year, Zalman introduced him to two other men who didn't identify themselves. "You've passed your test in Jerusalem, Eli," one of them said with a smile. "It's time to get to more serious matters." In a bare room at the Aman facility, Eli met a Muslim sheikh who patiently taught him the Quran and the Muslim prayers. Eli tried to concentrate but kept making mistakes. "Don't worry," his instructors told him. "If somebody starts asking you questions, tell them that you're not a devout Muslim and you only have vague religious memories from your days at school." Now, Eli was given a foretaste of his mission. He would soon be sent to a neutral country abroad, and after additional training, he would proceed to an Arab capital. "Which one?" he asked. "You'll be told in due time." Zalman went on. "You'll pose as an Arab, create local contacts, and establish an Israeli espionage network." Eli agreed without hesitating. He felt confident that he could carry out the mission. "You'll get papers of a Syrian or an Iraqi," his handlers told him. "Why? I don't know anything about Iraq. Get me Egyptian papers." "That's impossible," Zalman said. "The Egyptians have updated records of their population and of all the passports they have issued. That's too dangerous. Iraq and Syria don't have such records. They can't track you down." 2 days later, Zalman and his colleagues revealed to Ali his new identity. "Your name is Kamal. Your father's name is Amin Tabet, so your full name will be Kamal Amin Tabet." Ali's case officers had prepared a detailed legend, a cover story, for their new agent. "You're the son of Syrian parents. Your mother's name is Saida Ibrahim. You had a sister.
You were born in Beirut, in Lebanon. When you were 3, your family left Lebanon and moved to Egypt, to Alexandria. Don't forget your family is Syrian. A year later, your sister died. Your father was a textile merchant. In 1946, your uncle emigrated to Argentina. Shortly after, he wrote to your father and invited your family to join him in Buenos Aires. In 1947, all of you arrived in Argentina. Your father and your uncle established a partnership with a third person and opened a textile store, but it went bankrupt. Your father died in 1956, and 6 months later, your mother died too. You lived with your uncle and worked at a travel agency. You later went into business and were very successful. Eli now needed a cover story for his family as well. I got a job with a company that works with the Defense and Foreign Ministries, Eli told Nadia when he came back home. They need somebody to travel in Europe, buy tools, equipment, and materials for Taas, Israel's military industry, and find markets for its products. I'll come home often, for long leaves. I know that the separation will be hard, for both of us, but you'll get my full salary here, and in a few years we'll buy furniture in Europe and set up the apartment. In early February 1961, an unmarked car brought Eli to Lod Airport. A young man who identified himself as Gideon handed him an Israeli passport in his real name, $500, and a plane ticket to Zurich. On his arrival in Zurich, Eli was met by a white-haired man who took his passport and gave him a passport from a European country in another name. That passport carried an entry visa to Chile and a transit visa to Argentina. In Buenos Aires, our people will extend your transit visa, the man said, slipping into Eli's hand a plane ticket to Santiago with a stopover in Buenos Aires. Tomorrow you'll arrive in Buenos Aires. The day after, at 11 a.m., you should come to Café Corrientes. Our people will meet you there. Eli arrived in Argentina's capital and checked into a hotel. The following morning, at 11 o'clock on the dot, an elderly man came to his table at Café Corrientes and introduced himself as Abraham. Cohen was instructed to settle in a furnished apartment already rented for him. A local teacher would get in touch with him and teach him the Spanish language. "You'll have no other concerns," Abraham said. "I'll take care of your finances." 3 months later, Eli was ready for the next stage. He spoke passable Spanish, knew Buenos Aires well, dressed and behaved like thousands of Arab immigrants living in Argentina's capital. Another tutor trained him to speak Arabic with a Syrian accent. Abraham met him again in a cafe and handed him a Syrian passport in the name of Kamal Amin Tabet. "You must change your address by the end of the week," Abraham said. "Open a bank account in that name, start visiting the Arab restaurants, the cinemas where Arab movies are shown, and the Arab cultural and political clubs. Try to make as many friends as possible and establish contacts with the Arab community leaders. You are a man of means, a merchant, and a brilliant businessman. You are in the import-export business, but you also are involved in transports and investments. Make generous contributions to the charity funds of the Arab community. Good luck." The Israeli spy indeed had plenty of good luck. In a few months, Eli Cohen successfully penetrated the core of the Arab-Syrian community in Buenos Aires. His personal charm, confidence, common sense, and fortune attracted quite a few Arabs, among the most important in Argentina. He soon became a well-known figure in Arab circles. His breakthrough came in the Muslim club one evening when he met a dignified gentleman, well-dressed, balding, his face adorned with a bushy mustache. He introduced himself as Abdel Latif Hassan, editor-in-chief of the Arab World magazine published in Argentina. Hassan was deeply impressed with the serious personality of the Syrian immigrant, and the two of them became close friends. The cultural events at the clubs were followed by more intimate gatherings in the company of the Arab community leaders.
Eli made it to the Syrian embassy guest list and was invited to posh parties and receptions. At an official reception at the embassy, Hassan steered his friend Tabet to an imposing-looking officer dressed in the uniform of a Syrian general.
"Allow me to introduce a real and devoted Syrian patriot," Hassan said to the general, and then, turning to Ali, he added, "Meet General Amin El-Hafez, the military attaché at the embassy."
Ali seemed to have completed the final stage in establishing his legend. Time had come for the real espionage mission. Ali was briefed in a short, surreptitious meeting with Abraham in July 1961. The next day, he came to Hassan's office.
"I am sick and tired of living in Argentina," he admitted. He loved Syria more than anything and wanted to go back. Could Hassan help him with some letters of recommendation? The editor immediately wrote four letters, one to his brother-in-law in Alexandria, two to friends in Beirut, one of them a highly influential banker, and the fourth to his son in Damascus.